Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Manchester. I'd particularly like to welcome the Institute of Actuaries to Manchester on behalf of the Northwest Actuarial Society. We do have one official guest who's, I'm afraid, not actually arrived yet, so kind of in anticipation of his arrival, I'd like to welcome Paul Gray, who's Head of Operational Risk at Cooperative Financial Services, and also welcome any personal guests of members. I'm going to hand over to Nick to chair the meeting this evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. I'd like, first of all, to thank the Northwest Actuarial Society very much for acting as our hosts this evening, and particularly for choosing such a splendid location, for organising such excellent weather. And although I understand this is typical for Manchester at this time of year, and also for getting such a good audience to this meeting. I also hope that we will use this as an opportunity to depart from the rather formal approach we have for our meetings at Staple Inn, and that we'll have a relaxed and informal discussion. Of course, in order to have a discussion, we need to have some people who are prepared to stand up and say something, or even sit down and say something if you are more comfortable doing that. And I do hope that a number of you will be prepared to contribute to the discussion later on. The paper isn't a heavily technical one. It's about an area of risk management that many of us have some experience of, and I hope you'll be prepared to share your thoughts and experiences in that area. But before we get to the paper, I've got a few housekeeping announcements to make. First of all, the meeting's being filmed in order to produce a webcast, and we're hoping to make the webcast available to members only from Friday of this week. Secondly, fire alarms. The fire alarm for this building is a spoken announcement, and should there be such an announcement, you're asked to make your way calmly and efficiently to the assembly point, which is at the plaza next to the footbridge ramp. Next, anyone who'd like to claim CPD for this meeting and hasn't already signed the registration form by the entrance door, could they do so before they leave, please? And finally, can I ask you to turn off any BlackBerries and mobile phones, as the signals for both of those devices interfere with the sound system, and it isn't good enough just to mute the ringtone or put it to quiet, because your phone will still try and talk to its base, and that gets picked up by the equipment. That's the end of the housekeeping announcements. There's one more formality, though, before we get started, and that is the minutes of the Ordinary General Meeting held on the 26th of March 2007. Those have been displayed for the last few weeks on the Institute Notice Board at Staple Inn and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Yeah, good. Thank you very much. I will do that. Right, so the main event for this evening then is a paper by Paul Sweeting on the subject of modelling and managing risk, and I'd now like to invite Paul to introduce his paper.
And I'll try and do this from standing, and if people can't hear that, just put their hands up and I'll sit down and speak into the microphone instead. Good afternoon, and thank you for inviting me here to talk about modelling and managing risk. I'd like to also echo Nick's point about providing such a wonderful venue for this sessional meeting, just a stone's throw from Old Trafford, which, as a supporter of Leeds United, who are accelerating rapidly towards the conference, I can't think of anyone else would rather be at the moment, maybe just one or two places. This paper has a number of purposes. First, it's meant to outline the main risks faced by financial institutions and to look at how each risk applies similarly to each type of institution. Now, to me, this was the key section in the paper, since it examines the similarities and differences between these risks across institutions. Credit risk is a good example here. If you look at retail banks face credit risk from their loan books. Insurers face it mainly from reinsurer failure. And a pension scheme's greatest credit risk is the risk of sponsor failure. Now, these aspects of credit risk are very different and require quite different treatments. For example, modelling credit risk for a bank means finding a way of dealing with a vast number of very small, very different risks, whereas pension scheme sponsor risk is close to the credit analysis carried out by a rating agency for a single entity. But it's also worth noting that there are similarities between apparently very different risks. And one example that struck me was how similar credit risk and general insurance risk are. Both can be regarded as having aspects of incidence and intensity, and although the risk factors driving these two risks are very different, it at least suggests that general insurance actuaries at least already have the skills needed to assess credit risk. Now, the question of how to deal with risk is covered in the section on measuring and modelling. And this section did pose a problem in that I wanted to give enough information for the section to be useful, but not so much that the whole section was akin to a risk management, risk modelling textbook. And I hope I achieved that. And I would urge you to look at some of the references towards the end of the document if you'd like more information on some of these aspects of risk modelling, because there are a lot of books that I mentioned, and these give very clear and concise treatment to each of the different ways that you can model and manage risk. But in this section, I look not only at modelling each of the risks individually, but also the ways in which they interact. For example, going back to banks, if a bank is modelling credit risk on its loan book, then it's also going to take into account future economic prospects, since these will affect the likelihood of default. And the economy will be modelled consistently with capital markets. Now, a downturn in the economy will increase the rate of loan defaults, but will also coincide with a fall in interest rates, which will impact bond yields, and possibly a fall in equity markets. So these items should be modelled together. It's not enough to just treat them separately. I also look at how best to assess the results of any modelling carried out. Now, this is important, since many practitioners still regard risk as being equivalent to just the variance of returns. And there are many situations for which this just isn't appropriate. For example, if the risk is asymmetric, then a downside measure of risk is far more appropriate. More importantly, though, the variance may well tell us nothing about the capacity for risk that an investor has. Value at risk, or VAR type measures, are often more appropriate if what is important is the probability of a particular limit being breached. And if what happens in the tail of that particular distribution is important, then a measure such as expected shortfall is more appropriate. Finally, I look at some of the ways of actually managing these risks. And there are a number of analogies to be found in the ways in which different institutions manage risk. For example, changing investment strategy is an approach used by all financial institutions. And the main differences between institutions arise from the different regulatory environments in which the various types of firm operate. Similarly, changing the amount of capital backing an institution is used to varying degrees by all financial bodies. For a bank or insurer, this may be through the issuance of equity or debt. For a pension scheme, through the payment of additional contributions. I think the interesting differences here arise from the drives of each business. Does the level of business written drive the amount of capital required, or does the level of capital drive the amount of business that can be written? Investment banks generally follow the former route, adjusting the level and mix of capital as business opportunities change. However, insurance companies and retail banks face operational constraints on the level of change in business volume that can be achieved in the short term, so they're more likely to adjust their capital on a strategic basis rather than a tactical basis. Now, pension schemes generally change the level of capital in response to the business written. In other words, they'll change the level of contributions in response to accruing benefits and changes in surplus. But changing future benefits is also an option, and it is also worth considering the prospect of risk sharing, so where the level of business or members' benefits are subject to greater changes in exchange for greater predictability around capital requirements, or, in other words, contributions. A related area is the area of capital market risk transfer. Banks have been very active in this market for a very long time, converting books of loans into securities which are then traded, and extending this more recently into multi-tranche collateralised debt obligations, or CDOs. Insurance companies have been involved in this market to an extent as well, in terms of the issuance of catastrophe bonds, and life insurance companies have followed suit with mortality catastrophe bonds more recently. Now, there's perhaps less scope for pension schemes to go down this route. You need to be of a large enough size to come up with enough risk to sell to the market. But things like credit default swaps or similar instruments can be used to mitigate sponsor credit risk. And there is growing interest in the market for mortality with survivor bonds and, more plausibly, swaps being discussed extensively. So what are the main messages in this paper, or at least what are they meant to be? I think the first message is consider all risks together. Now, in many cases, this is already done. Anecdotally, I understand that banks use enormously complex and wide-ranging models to ensure that all risks are considered at the same time with a consistent approach to modelling. And insurance companies do use the model office for looking at all risks together. Pension schemes perhaps need to ensure that their approaches are similarly holistic. Investment risk, contribution rates and sponsor credit risk should be considered together, not separately. The second point I think is important is to recognise that there are similarities between some of these risks and that actuaries can use their skills in many of these areas. General insurance risk and credit risk are not that different. Pension scheme sponsor credit risk can be modelled by actuaries and it can be done consistently with the other risks borne by a pension scheme, investment risk in particular. I think as a profession, our reaction to changes in financial markets should be to seize these opportunities to move into new areas and not necessarily to retreat into our core practice areas. And I think that's probably the key message that I was wanting to try and get across in this paper. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much, Paul. Right, I'd now like to ask Malcolm Kent to open the discussion, please.
Right, I've just got a few slides. I find that it's usually a bit more coherent when you listen to me if I've also got a few slides in front of me. When I read Paul's paper, I came to the conclusion that really it was quite a well-written generalist paper. It covers quite a wide range of different things. And thank you very much indeed, Paul, for the amount of effort that no doubt has gone into coming up with such a paper. And I'm very hopeful that it will prove a very fruitful discussion a way of framing our discussions going forwards. This evening on modelling and managing risk. It's what I would describe as a generalist paper in the traditional actuarial mould, and I'll try and explore that a little bit further. It's pretty wide-ranging. It contains a lot that makes a lot of sense, or at least that seems to make a lot of sense to actuaries. It's presented in what I believe to be a coherent fashion. Obviously, you're entitled to your own views on that topic. It's got a few simplifications en route, but it's pretty wide-ranging and, I think, well-written, so thank you very much. It's relatively non-mathematical, as Paul's already highlighted, so it's not really for those of you who are out-and-out quants. I'm a relatively mathematical person myself, so I probably would have liked a few more sort of equations and mathematical symbols and things like that within it. It's also not got an awful lot of focus on governance. Within my company, I work for an asset management business. The risk is split into two parts. There's a sort of market credit, sort of investment kind of risk side, and then there's this more compliance, operational risk kind of side to things. And the former is a bit more mathematical, and the latter is a bit more focused on ensuring that you you have the right procedures and protocols and that kind of stuff. So there isn't an awful lot on procedures and protocols and how you actually go about mitigating operational risk or that kind of thing. So it isn't really focused on that either. It's sort of more the halfway house that probably is where a lot of actuaries are at. The thing, therefore, you know, you read a paper like this, you've got to figure out how you're going to encourage the discussion. And I hope this isn't just a sort of hang my hat on in order to get you folks to chip in. But I want to pose the question of whether the traditional actuarial mould and the actuarial paradigms and the kind of flavour that permeates throughout the paper will actually be the right way to think of modelling and managing risk going forwards. So it's a very good paper within that mould, but question, is that mould the way the world is going to be in the years to come? I said the paper was wide-ranging. It covers things like the link between risk and capital. It covers who typically looks after or advises the different parties in the different sorts of financial institutions it covers. It looks at the main types of risk affecting the different institutions. It's got quite a lot on how to measure and model and assess risk, and so it's following what you might call the traditional actuarial paradigm. And it talks about how you and the different ways of managing risk, raising capital, changing your business mix. It, of course, has, for an actuarial paper, a good plug for actuaries and also for the idea of coherent risk management systems. And clearly, nobody's going to plug incoherent risk management systems. But by that, it means try and identify all the different sorts of risk. But it does contain a hint, just a hint, that not everybody sees the world in an actuarial, at least a traditional actuarial light. And that's in section 8.1.1. It contains much that's very difficult to dispute. As I said, makes my job as an opener slightly more challenging. It's got some pretty good broad descriptions of many of the different players that exist within this marketplace, of the techniques that actuaries use to advise those players. It picks up on a number of themes that I'm sure make a lot of sense to you, like how important demographic risk is to defined benefit pension schemes, the impact of behavioural finance, behavioural biases. And it does have some good sections on areas that are probably a little bit less familiar to some actuaries, like how credit rating agencies typically carry out credit risk analysis and some of the linkages or some of the ways in which you can apply the same kind of concepts outside the credit risk area and in some other areas that actuaries get involved with. So I do think the paper is almost certainly correct in its conclusion that actuaries do have a role to play in a broader range of risk management activities than is currently the case. And actually, a lot of actuaries do have those skills. And maybe you can share some of your examples of how you've been involved in those sorts of areas and how you can see risk management and risk modelling, how it could be applied in different areas. So please do highlight a number of those during the discussion. There are, as I said, a few simplifications en route. The FSA, there's two things that the paper describes as the broad reasons or rationales for the episode. It does actually have one or two other aims, and one that I think is actually important to my later comments is the idea that the FSA actually wants to encourage UK competitiveness. So you've got to look at how other people do things, and competitiveness and focusing on the way in which different people operate is perhaps something the FSA would want us to encourage. It talks about pricing teams within banks focusing on pricing, not too surprising, but one of the things that they also get quite heavily involved with is the idea of hedging. So the price that banks and possibly other similar teams, what they get involved with, the idea of hedging is actually a very, very important idea. If you can't hedge something, then maybe that alters the price at which you're prepared to put on something. So hedging and pricing are both important in terms of what these different teams do. There's something for the mathematicians amongst you in terms of mean variance analysis. There's an assertion that it's never appropriate when the distributions aren't jointly elliptical, which is not strictly accurate. And then it does mention market risk as being secondary to admissibility, whilst clearly the admissibility issues can affect things. Typically market risk is more important, certainly as in terms of earnings at risk and that kind of thing. So usually admissibility rules aren't a real practical constraint on insurance companies. So I guess the thing that I want to just focus on is whether the framework within which it's put, this paper, is actually going to be one that will work well in the coming years. And what do I mean by the traditional actuarial approach, which I think is very well articulated or very well kind of encapsulated by this paper? Typically, when I think of how actuaries traditionally do things, they come up with a range of scenarios. They work out what's the likelihood of this occurring or that occurring or something else occurring, and they build up some kind of distribution of events. It's typically based on looking at what has happened in the past and inferring from that and some inspired common sense, otherwise known as actuarial judgment, what might happen in the future. And it's a little bit more mathematically focused than it is governance focused. Usually there are, there's a wide range of different skills that actuaries bring to the table, but typically they've got a bit more of a mathematical background. But I'll let you into a secret, which is that not everybody believes that actuaries are the best thing since sliced bread and that they know everything there is to know about risk management. Not everyone, you know, holds the actuaries in quite the high level of esteem that we would like them to, or perhaps it's justifiable that they are. So it's something that you just need to be aware that there are other ways of looking at things. And I guess when I try to figure out why that might be, take the paper and skip out all the stuff between the existence of a link between risk and capital and the view that maybe not everybody is, you know, fully wedded to this idea that actuaries have everything right. And so it seems to me that the area that's perhaps there's a potential challenge here is the way that actuaries and this traditional actuarial framework that's encapsulated in this paper, is this the way that people really focus on the link between risk and capital? Now, I wrote a paper a couple of years back which tried to explore this kind of concept. And it, in effect, argued that when you ultimately want to think about risk and capital and this link, that drives you down to what I was endeavouring to argue was market-consistent risk management approaches. And the idea there is, instead of looking at what you yourself believe is going to happen, you look at what the market believes is going to happen. So it's driven by the market. And I mentioned this idea of pricing and hedging. Unless something is hedgeable and therefore has some kind of ability to look at take a view within the market, maybe you are less interested in taking on board that risk. There is a substantial body of risk management that occurs that is very, very focused on market consistent analyses and projections and distributions and that kind of thing. And so it's hinted at in the paper. There's in 8.1.1, there's a reference to the fact that other parts of the financial services industry do seem to place more attention on market consistent risk management than actuaries. Paul actually did mention collateralized debt obligations, and when I thought about this a while back, the thing that struck me most of all about CDOs is that a CDO can have any sort of risk whatsoever and convert it into credit risk form. So all risks are, in some sense, fungible. Collateralized debt obligation is a structure where you have some assets and you fund them with something else. So you issue bits of paper that have a different priority. So in this particular chart, you've got, this is your liabilities, that's the debt or the equity or whatever it is that you've issued, and you then buy some things with it. And the reason that it's important is because you can actually repackage any sort of risk that you like into one of these CDOs. They don't have to be collateralized debt obligations. They could be collateralized loan or collateralized equity or collateralized funding or whatever it is. And when you kind of then think about that, you can actually repackage any type of financial institution whatsoever and think of that as being equivalent to one of these CDOs. And as a result, I think that when you try and gather together a coherent framework that looks at every single type of financial institution, you need to take into account the way in which a CDO, which is a prototypical version of any type of financial institution, is actually looked at by the market that deals in CDOs. One of the things, therefore, I would have wanted Paul Sweeting's paper to have a little bit more focus on is the importance of priority ranking within the capital structure, because that in effect is what a CDO is based on and therefore drives you to think about that. So why would I want a higher priority ranking? Clearly because it's less risky. What does that then mean in terms of the price that I'm prepared to transact and trade that risk? What does it mean for a capital in that sense? So those were just the thoughts that I had, and I welcome your thoughts too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. That's certainly given us plenty to think about for the discussion. The discussion's now open to the floor. Obviously, the paper's covered a fairly wide area, but the subject of the discussion is risk management and risk modelling and risk measurement. And I think it's legitimate to talk about any aspects of those. Of that subject, whether it's covered in the paper or not. Can I ask at this stage how many people have in mind that they might like to say something in the discussion? You're not committing yourself by putting your hand up, but it would be useful to get some sort of idea of how many people are intending to speak. Some. Good. Yes, okay. Right. Okay, I don't think we're going to need to restrict the time that you speak for, though. Please don't let the fact that the meeting's being recorded deter you from contributing, because The main points of the discussion will be published in abstract form in the BAJ. We're not intending to have a verbatim record of the discussion, although of course it will be on camera. Roving microphones are available, and I'd ask you to wait for a microphone to be brought to you before you begin speaking. And please also state your name clearly before you make your contribution. So can I ask for the first speaker? Who'd like to go first? Someone needs to be brave. Yes, Derek.
Thanks. My name's Derek Pike. I'd like to sort of add my thanks to tonight's author, not least for giving us a paper that we can all read and that, as Malcolm's pointed out, doesn't have a difficult formula or graphs in it. The author states his purpose in the first paragraph, which sounded initially to me quite ambitious, that is to assess the techniques and, available for financial risk management and to discuss the use of these methods, and which sounds more, as Paul said in his introduction, like what you would get in a textbook, and rather than in a 40-page paper. And for instance, the standard textbook in many business schools is Risk Management by Crowe, Mark and Galli, runs to over 800 pages. Having said that, I mean, I think it's a very valuable overview of just how wide the available techniques for risk management now are, and especially I approve of the author's approach of looking first at the users of risk information and at the needs of those users, which is exactly the approach that the Board for Actuarial Standards has just taken in its the development of the conceptual framework in the paper we published last week. Just thought I'd get that plug in. I got to the end of the paper and I got to the conclusion in 8.1.3, unlike Malcolm, the conclusion seemed rather sweeping to me, that many actuaries already have the skills and knowledge necessary for a far wide, broader range of risk management activities. Perhaps it's because the immediately preceding paragraphs on the same page appear to lead readers to the conclusion that, for instance, pensions actuaries have a lot to learn from banks on credit risk and so on before they'll be able to model and manage the risks of pension schemes. And I wondered if it might be fair to say that actuaries already have the skills to acquire the knowledge and techniques in the future. I was interested in the sort of use of the Basel stroke FSA categorisation, which is something I've been thinking about recently. The author started to use it in sections 4 and 5, but he seemed to find it difficult to carry through this particular categorisation to the risks of insurance and pensions. I think it's very useful to have a categorisation scheme for when you're identifying risks. And I think the FSA scheme's as good as any for that. But once you've identified the risks, I wonder if the it's worth pursuing this particular categorisation scheme when you come to modelling and managing the risks. And finally, on a technical point, 6.2.14 states that VAR and expected shortfall are special cases of spectral risk measures. I haven't read the Acerbi paper, but my understanding, based on the Dowd and Blake's paper, is that because VAR lacks this property of monotonicity, that is, the total portfolio should be less than or equal to the sum of the sub-portfolio VARs, then I understood that VAR can't be a spectral risk measure, whether or not it's weighted by a risk aversion function. And so I'd be interested if the author can explain that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Derek. Who'd like to go next? Yes. Tim.
Thanks. Tim Burse. I think, like the opener, I'd support the author's conclusion that actuaries have the skills to work in this area. And in that respect, I take issue a bit with the previous speaker. I think we are doing some work in the education syllabus to look at how we can build risk management into the syllabus a bit more. And in fact, when we look at the substantive subject, which is CA1, that has this in, we find that it's really quite a lot of it is there already in slightly different words and in a slightly different order that one might put in if we were driving that subject through a risk management approach. So I don't think there is actually very much new that actuaries need to learn or need to know about this. We might just have to sort of reorder our thoughts slightly. So I think that's one point I'd like to make. Like some of the other speakers, I'm very keen on the absence of equations. Because I think one issue that was touched on a bit in the paper, but hasn't been touched on the previous speaker, is what do you do with operational risk? The banks go quite a long way in quite a lot of detail about the other risks with lots of models, and then add a percent on the top, a few. In the work that the FSA have been pushing insurance companies to do for their ICAs, we have done a lot more operational risk analysis. But it is still very much the actuarial judgment or the applied common sense that comes in there. And I sort of question that if you're going to put a large dollop of applied common sense on the top, what real benefit do you get from doing a huge amount of work on detailed numbers lower down? That's my second point. And I think my final point is a sort of cautionary warning, perhaps, to possibly actuaries in my vintage, in that work I've seen on this topic, actuaries tend to know that they're supposed to be starting with best estimates and applying risk margins and risk analysis techniques. But their best estimate is really, this is the best estimate, but it's on the prudent side of best because we've always been prudent. And I think we just need to beware that if we're talking about a best estimate, we've got to be open and really say that the risk of deviation in either direction is 50% one way or the other. And not really, this is our best estimate, but we really assume it'll only go wrong in one direction. But I thought it was an easy-to-read paper, for which I thank the author. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much, Tim. Just to add a couple of comments to what Tim said about the education developments. Certainly, the Education and CPD Board is looking at revamping the syllabus for the core applications subject to include more specific risk management material, or at least to present it in a slightly clearer format. The UK profession is also participating in an evaluation of a possible global actuarial risk management qualification, which is being studied in conjunction with a number of other actuarial bodies from around the world, mainly at the moment the English-speaking world, it has to be said. And the idea is to try and produce some common qualification, some global qualification that can be achieved by sitting a subset of the institute and faculty's own exams, concentrating on risk management topics. That's in its early stages. It really is only at the evaluation stage, but there hopefully will be more news on where that's heading before the end of this year. And then finally, there are also plans to introduce a specialist risk management option at specialist applications and specialist technical level, as I understand it. I'm sure Trevor Watkins will correct me if I've got it wrong. So there's quite a lot of focus on improving actuaries' skills in the risk management area, and I think as that process proceeds, it will be important to have input from people like Malcolm, so that we don't just look at it from a traditional actuarial perspective, and we do recognise what's going on in the outside world. Can I ask who would like to go next? Yes, there's a hand in the middle there. I can't see a face, but I can see a hand.
Oh. Hello, sorry.
Geraldine, yes.
Of course, who else? I'd also like to thank everybody who's spoken so far for the clarity of what they've said, because risk management is an area where things are not always as clear. Nick at the beginning said that if anyone wanted to speak about measurement, they were welcome to, and that was when I decided I'd like to speak. I'm on a working party of the Society of Actuaries. You see, I do get around a bit. And the working party is on enterprise risk management. What the working party has wanted to do is create a list of frequently asked questions. And what I'm doing is leading the compilation of it and making sure that it's understandable. What we want to do is put it up onto a website. It may actually form, help with what Nick was saying about the education part. The way that we want to do it is a bit, try and make it a bit more like an idiot's guide to risk management. And I would welcome anybody who wants to send me frequently asked questions, but with an answer, please. And we've set up a dedicated email address, erm@gaps.com. And the way that we'll do it is once we get a question, we'll use tracking on the question and send it, if we've made any alterations to it, send it round to various people to make sure that haven't done silly alterations. Then probably send it back to the person who's sent it to us to make sure they're happy with it, and it will then go onto the website. Obviously, once it's on the website and open to proper scrutiny and peer review, we'll then be happy to take other comments, but with a bit of luck, there won't be many dramatic changes once they've gone to the website. Thank you.
Very good. Thanks very much, Geraldine. Yes. Paul Gray.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I'm not an actuary, so I actually work in operational risk. So I'm sort of the bridge between the actuaries and the business, in effect, to some degree. I think one of the challenges about enterprise risk management is how we look at all the different risk categories. And when you've got risks which often are displaced from one category to another, so, for example, how often does an operational risk cause a credit risk event? Or if we're, you know, how often does a default result in loss because the legal documentation is not robust enough? So I think there's quite a big option in there. So, for example, how often do we do outsourcing to transfer risk in terms of process or systems to a specialist, and then we can very often result in increased credit risk in case that supplier defaults or goes bust and we lose our services. And that's where I think if we can integrate the measurement of those types of risks across the categories, then at the end of the day, the business wants to understand what risks they're taking, regardless of what risk categories they are. Just touching on the point of if we just put operational risk figures in, a few percent here or there, why do we bother with all of the work? I think the real benefit is, from the business point of view, understanding what risks they take day to day, and how big or how small those risks are, and how probable or not they are to occur. And that's useful from a bottom-up feed in terms of capital. But there are two dimensions. So the total impact of a risk occurring with a 0.5% probability may be quite large and on the tail. But from a business point of view, it's really the probability of a risk occurring with a much smaller loss that day-to-day people tend to manage in terms of profit and loss. Because that's going to drive your predictive and your detective controls, not necessarily your mitigative controls, because that's when the event occurs. So even though the tail event may still be very high, what you're trying to do is reduce probability of the event. So it's really around, do the business know what risk they take? And almost the capital is a secondary benefit.
Very good. Thank you very much. And the next contribution. Yes, one right at the back, I think.
Anthony Toole from CIS. Firstly, can I thank the author and all the speakers for everything they've said, and echo the author's slight discomfort of being so close to Old Trafford as a City supporter. It's the first sessional meeting I've attended, so I've learnt a lot this evening. One of the things I've learnt is that, surprisingly, not everybody loves and respects actuaries quite as much as we do, and that they have a more market-consistent perhaps even gut feeling to dealing with risk. And would it possibly not be an idea that actuaries move slightly more towards governance as opposed to being entirely or largely mathematical? And would it also be an idea that we expended more energy in actually advertising ourselves, showing what we can do? And in fact, would we be not more would people be more receptive to us if we had moved slightly more towards the governance side of looking at risk?
Thank you very much. We'll pick those questions up later on. Who'd like to go next? Yes, Donald.
Donald Duval. I thought the paper was extremely interesting. I think that as a profession, we need to try and have more of this kind of thing. There are too often cases where different actuaries from different disciplines trying to solve the same problem come up with different answers for no other reason than that we've grown up differently. I, like the opener, would have liked to see more on the stakeholder part. I thought the figure one diagram was fascinating. I'm not sure I agree with how Paul's allocated everybody in each of the individual cases, but as an intellectual exercise, if you try and do it on every case you are involved in, work out who all the stakeholders are and which box you would put them in and why, it's quite fascinating, and I found it pretty illuminating since I saw the first draft of this paper. Partly because the actuarial profession, to a great extent, has grown up in areas where rights and obligations have been pretty unclear. The basic actuarial method 40 years ago was We'll do the right thing in 40 years' time. My successor will do the right thing, whatever that might be. And that possibly worked well, possibly didn't. More recently, it certainly hasn't. There's been things like the way orphan surplus has developed, the way benefits and pensions have moved from being objectives to guarantees, and in fact some of the stakeholders, if you drew look at that diagram, have moved quite dramatically from where they are located during the time of their relationship with an institution. With-profits policyholders clearly at one time fell into the provider equity box. More recently they've probably been treated far more as customers, and interestingly, if you're a customer in an institution that's not trying to sell new business, you tend to get pretty awfully treated, because there's no reason why you should be treated any better. There's also confusion about where things like operational risk land. The biggest operational risk cost we've seen, I would say, was pensions mis-selling. And where that landed, God knows, but it certainly wasn't where anyone knew it was going to land beforehand. And I think there are two issues. One is the one the opener brought out, which is where the priority of claims are, which is quite important. But the second one is where the power lies. And life companies and defined benefit pension funds are pretty similar institutions in many respects, with one massive difference, which is who appoints the people who run them and what the objectives are of the people who run them. In a life company, it's very clear, it's the shareholders. In a pension fund, it's a much more complex and arcane process. And therefore, the behaviour of the two institutions at the governance level is entirely different. So it's not just what people's legal claims are, it's where the rights are of who actually is running the place. I thought the question of the previous speaker and the opener about consistency of risk models and actuarial models and market consistent ones is fascinating. It's particularly interesting with risks that float in and out of being in the market. Reinsurance risks, like catastrophe bonds, for example, are a tiny proportion of the amount of catastrophe risk actually placed, and really they only come up in a big way when the reinsurance market has run out of capital. Most of the time, most cat risk goes through the reinsurance market, which behaves differently, prices risk differently from the other market. And we're maybe seeing this with mortality. Currently, almost all mortality transfers at the moment are on actuarial models of one form or another, theoretical models. We might be seeing a market model develop, and the market doesn't have to be logical, and there's no reason why it should be. There has to be non-arbitrage, but it doesn't have to be logical beyond that. And in fact, mortality, I think, is an interesting example where holistic risk measurement, although interesting, clearly vital for institutions as a whole, actually there's a lot to be said for not looking at mortality holistically at all, but simply looking at mortality in great depth as an individual issue. If you're trying to do pricing, holistic risk becomes much less important. And the final comment I've got is, can actuaries do this? I think they possibly can, but not if we're frightened of equations. Clearly, the one thing actuaries have got to offer in this area is mathematical. I think this paper is entirely right that it doesn't need equations because it's got all the references in. But if, as practicing actuaries, we are not comfortable with the equations, there's no point in using us for risk management.
Very good. Thank you very much, Donald. Can we have the next contribution? No, nobody wanting to say anything just at the moment. One of the comments that you made, Paul, in your introduction was that sponsor credit risk for pension funds can be measured by actuaries. And as I understand it, the Pensions Board took a contrary view on that subject and concluded that really sponsor credit risk wasn't an area where the profession had a lot of expertise and that we should really leave it to the experts, the rating agencies and accounting firms and others to do that sort of work. Is that an area that either you would like to say any more about or anyone in the audience would like to pick up?
Well, I'm happy to chip in first with my view, which is pretty much diametrically opposed to the pension board's view. If you have a very large, complex institution
and you want to accurately measure credit risk for the purposes of a bondholder thinking of or rather it's going to be the firm which buys it ultimately, the bondholder is going to rely on the credit rating to see how likely it is to get its money back at the end of it, then a credit rating agency can add an awful lot to the discussion there by looking at things like the covenants on the debt, the various priorities, the different forms of debt, looking at the how likely it believes a firm would be to want to default on its debt, looking at the firm's motivations and so on and so forth. Now, if you're looking at a smaller firm, the chances are that the rating agency isn't going to be able to bother to do that for a reasonable fee. You're going to be able to come up with about as good an answer doing something quantitatively by looking at things like financial accounting ratios. And importantly, whatever the credit rating agency does, the chances of it taking into account at all the asset allocation of the pension scheme or even the interest rate sensitivity of the liabilities is pretty much nil. And that is a really important point when you're looking at the creditworthiness of the sponsoring employer. If you have a sponsor which where its creditworthiness is very closely tied to the equity market, then you really want to have that taken into account when you're looking at the size of the sponsor covenant and how much you'd like that sponsor to put in and at what point. And anybody not taking that into account is likely to seriously underestimate the amount of risk being taken.
Hmm. Presumably strategic risk is quite an important part of evaluating the sponsor covenant, though. In other words, is the business model going to continue to work for long enough for the contributions to continue to be paid, and is that an area where actuaries have enough understanding?
But we're looking, if you look at the number of pension schemes in the UK, the number of pension schemes where the sponsor is large enough for it to be worthwhile and cost effective to get a credit rating agency in to look at the strength of the business model and that particular firm's expected profitability over the next few years, I think the money could be better spent by putting it straight into the pension scheme.
I understand. Yeah. Any other views on that or any other aspects?
The view that I've got on some of these things is that there's a risk, but the risk, you need to take into account your own business risk, and maybe the pensions board is reminding actuaries that to claim competence in areas where they might have competence but it might be shown that they didn't is itself risky for actuaries. And just as an example, there's clearly a link between what actuaries do in a variety of fields and what credit rating agencies do, but neither of them are necessarily going to be perfect. There is an issue that one of the credit rating agencies has got at the moment, Moody's. They've come up with the idea of sovereign guarantees, so that they change their ratings to take into account the likelihood that the sovereign entity, the country, will actually support the relevant bank. And this has led to huge changes in a few of the ratings that they've assigned to a number of relatively unusual banks. So they've gone out and they've explained all of these details, how they've actually done things in a lot of detail. It's meant very substantial ratings changes, and of course people have got, they've said this doesn't make a lot of sense, and they've now had to reverse those decisions, or at least partially reverse them. So they're in the process of moving around, so they're kind of like losing a little bit of face because of that. And it does seem to me that they do have the luxury that it's unlikely to affect their business long term. The entities are unlikely to go bust whilst they kind of sort things out. But it's a lesson in the risks of being very careful in how you set out things, in that it can kind of come back in to haunt you. And so I think as actuaries, we don't have the luxury typically of the kind of balance sheets and a PI cover and the like that some of these other players have. And so I suspect the Pensions Board was making the point that whilst actuaries might be able to contribute to this debate, they need to think carefully about their own business risk in doing so.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Who? Yes, Nigel.
Nigel Bankhead. I'll make a comment on the question of the credit issue, which I'll try and tie into the comments I was going to make in any event. So thank you for to the preparer of the paper, very wide-ranging, and also to Malcolm's introduction, which also prompted me to make some comments. One issue that comes out, and it probably starts being relevant to pensions, is the comment in 2.1.7 of the paper, which states that the interests of debt holders is actually protected by the Financial Reporting Council, my employer. And it is an interesting proposition, that, an assertion, because when you read the work done by the various boards, you find the Accounting Standards Board starts out by looking at the various people who use accounts and recognises the existence of a lot of stakeholders, but concludes it will prepare accounts from the position of the equity shareholder. So that's how accounts are prepared, and that's what's audited. And that in itself drives some of the problems that then go into the question of looking at sponsor covenant. That in fact a pension scheme is broadly in the position of a debt holder, yet accounts are prepared on a going concern principle. And one of the big questions is then, well, how do you convert the financial information that you have, which is going concern, and try and look at potential recovery if that's not the case? So that requires you to do a lot of work which isn't directly statistical. It requires you to know a lot about finance. And also, when I did some work with some recovery people, you also need to know a bit about how businesses are likely to be sold or disposed of in that position. And they would often have two approaches, one of which they tend to refer to as a pre-pack sale, where the insolvency practitioners manage to sell off the business as a going concern, which would give you a higher value. And you get a lower value if in actual fact you're reduced to selling the assets. And that is quite difficult for a pensions actuary to say, well, I've got that familiarity, so from a going concern balance sheet, this is how it would convert, and this is the dividend distribution that would then come through to the pension scheme. But it does lead to that question of information, if you like, the point I was going to make, which perhaps ties in a bit with Malcolm. The question is really the conundrum posed by this concept of the perfect market. What exactly is it? Is it the all-knowing market, or is it the perfectly processing market? If it's all-knowing, why does it actually need any information to determine price? Doesn't it just determine price? But is that its role? Or is it, in actual fact, something which needs to be given perfect information to operate properly? So it can determine price if it's given information along the way. Which leads to the question, which comes up in accounts, how is the market distorted according to where the information is given and how it's given? And it's well known that some information on the face of the accounts is likely to lead to a different answer when you convert it through to price than if you bury it in the notes. Well, a perfect market shouldn't do that. It's all public information that is there. But if you follow that through and you take it to the area of risk, you then come to ask the question, well, what is the market and what does it need? And if it's pricing risk, does it need the answer if it's the determinant of price itself? Or is it that it needs information? And what it needs to determine price is some sort of reliable information, like accounts, that it can process when it's setting price. And then what is that information? And that might answer the question, I think, Malcolm, you said, well, in actual fact, the market view of price is very relevant, but is that actually relevant to the information that's given? And that, I think that's the point I wanted to raise.
Thank you very much. Does anyone want to come back on that at this point? Doesn't look like it. Malcolm, did you want to say anything about... Donald raised the question about, you know, it's fine using market information where there's a deep, liquid and transparent market, but for things like mortality where there isn't and nobody really knows where the market, whether the market has a good feel for the underlying value.
Clearly, some markets are more liquid than others and deeper than others. I think I find interesting the degree to which people take into account that depth outside the actuarial profession. Again, maybe harping back on one or two of the other comments I've made. The less that the assumption that you know everything is a potentially risky assumption, the less easy it is to find out things in the market about a certain type of risk, the more people shy away from that risk in terms of trading it. So you could argue that actuaries have been kindly bequeathed the task of handling things that are not very well catered for by other people, I don't want to knock the importance of our profession in terms of helping in society and helping in the way in which these types of risks are managed. But when you do start to see more evidence in terms of what the market price is being placed on a particular sort of risk, then it seems to me that it does behove actuaries to be becoming and thinking more about those kinds of things. And it also, I think, behoves actuaries to bear in mind that the risks that you can't trade in the market are, by definition, less hedgeable than the ones that you can. And that in itself creates a risk, which perhaps we haven't focused on as much as we might have done in the past.
Thank you. Who's going to go next? Come on, you won't get 2 hours of CPD unless we carry on until 7 o'clock. So somebody's got to say something.
I've got a few points to make, if anyone's gone quiet.
Yes, sorry. Yeah, thank you. Right. Yes, Mike.
Okay, thanks. As you might expect from someone who has to close the discussion at the end of the evening, I did have the opportunity to go through the paper in some detail over the weekend, and there were three or four little points that I thought it might be worth just mentioning that's cropped up mainly, in fact, in section 4 as I went through the paper. In section 4.6.5, the author refers to anchoring being effectively perhaps basing your belief rather too much on the continuity of the past. And of course, there are indeed many examples of this that we can easily name. Yet I think something like the overreaction to AIDS in the UK actuarial community is a good example of an opposite risk, namely being a little bit too ready to believe in a new theoretical model. In section 4.6.3, the role of an employed insurance company actuary with regard to regulatory reporting is cited as an example of agency risk. However, such reporting is now subject to audit, even in life insurers, and is the ultimate responsibility of the board in any case. When taken with the what we hope we still can class as actuarial professionalism, I'm not at all convinced that this is actually a particularly good example. In 4.4.5, I'd also like to take a polite issue with the assertion that the main credit risk for insurers is inevitably reinsurer failure. Failure or failures following the occurrence of catastrophic or pandemic events may indeed be a serious risk. However, exposures in respect to financial reinsurances can often be collateralised, and for some life insurers at least, the credit risk from their corporate bond portfolio can significantly exceed that from their reinsurance. In 4.4.6, whilst the financial strength of annuity buyout firms is indeed an important consideration for pension schemes considering buying out their liabilities, the scheme actuary assessing this option also has to bear in mind the cover provided by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. In section 5.1.10, the author refers quite rightly to the possibility that the association between different types of risk are greater in circumstances of extreme stress than in normal times. However, I think one needs to question carefully whether this really justifies the, as it often is, description. For example, I looked recently at the 10 years of the largest percentage changes in UK equity markets in the 20th century and found that they did not coincide with the 10 years of the largest percentage changes in interest rates. And finally, in section 4.2, the demographic risk of sickness, including critical illness and permanent disability, should not be overlooked. Indeed, permanent health business can act as an additional natural hedge, besides annuities, to pandemic risk in a life insurance portfolio, both due to death of claimants and to the release of reserve on death, for at least for guaranteed premium rate business.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mike. Catherine, do you want to?
Thank you. Just wanted to catch up something that Paul said in his introduction. I'm unfortunate enough to work for a company that has a general insurance company where I'm an actuary, a life insurance company and a bank. So over the last year, I've spent some time getting familiar with the Basel II regulations. And it does definitely strike me that there are a lot of similarities between general insurance actuarial work and, as you mentioned, Paul, credit risk assessment, particularly in pricing, for example, in a retail book of personal loans, for example, looking at some of the rating factors that could be used, and that you have your probability of default, which is akin to a frequency of loss, and your loss given default, which is akin to severity of a particular claim. And I think general insurance actuaries could be helpful to banks in terms of looking at exposure to bad debt, using some of the techniques we use in assessing our exposure to floods and storms and so on, and also in setting reserves to bad debts based on past claims experience, past default experience, and linking that to the economy. So I think there is definitely something to learn there. And also, becoming more familiar with Basel has been helpful in the work that I've done on Solvency II, and I think this paper is very useful for Solvency II because there's a lot of thinking going on about how the new solvency regime will work across Europe. It's going to be very principles based, which is new in at least 26 of the European Union member states, and there's going to be an awful lot of thinking needed around the internal models that will be used for assessing capital in life and general insurers in Europe, particularly as the FSA have started explaining to the UK industry that one of the main differences between Solvency II and ICAS is that it's models that will need to be approved, not the capital figure. And they're telling people, warning people, that most of the ICA models in the UK, as they stand at the moment, won't be usable under Solvency II. This is obviously causing some panic. I think it's probably quite right that we should be reading this paper and thinking about how we can use this thinking, learning from one industry to another, in terms of making our insurance models usable for Solvency II. The key difference is, as I said, that the models have to be approved, which is the case under Basel, so it's worth looking at what the banks are doing. And there's also going to be links with IFRS, with new accounting standards coming in, and that's going to provide a link between Solvency II accounting and published information, so there's a lot of changes coming along. One of the things that Solvency II hasn't tackled very well, in my opinion, is the governance around risk management. And you mentioned in the paper, Paul, about enterprise risk management, which is something that I'm very interested in. I think it is really important to have a good risk management system in order to do that and to bring all your risks together across a whole enterprise. But one of the key things that we need is to have people who understand and believe in risk management and also the appropriate culture. If you have a blame culture, then you aren't going to get information about losses, actual losses and near misses, because nobody's going to admit to them. So it's very, very key that we don't just have systems for assessing capital, systems for assessing risk, but that each company that wants to introduce an ERM system introduces a no-blame culture, or my personal preference, that people are blamed when they start hiding things, and you sack them then, but not when they actually make a mistake. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Right, who? It's the audience's turn now, I think. Who'd like to go next? Tim.
Tim Bunch. Like previous speakers, I found that this was a good all-round summary. But I was rather left with the feeling that there are a lot of embryonic techniques out there, but potentially problems with all of them. So I came to the conclusion that maybe in many cases we would end up falling back on judgment, but I'm sure it wasn't the author's intention that I should come to that conclusion. Overall, no magic solutions, I think, was the feeling I came away with. And one or two of the areas of difficulty that I noted down were, first of all, the question of what is the best estimate, which has been referred to already this evening. It did say in 5.1.5 about best estimates that it would be helpful to define what we mean by best estimate, but I'm still waiting for the definition. Another area of difficulty, what distribution should we be using for each risk type? It's a temptation to use normal distributions in the absence of anything else, but of course we all know that that can be quite dangerous because the tails aren't necessarily representative of extreme risk. There's the question of how to allow for correlations between the different risks and distributions. Use of correlation matrices is quite common, but usually the parameters that go in those are chosen fairly subjectively. There's the area of difficulty of modelling of operational risk, where I think a lot more work needs to be done to bring us up to speed on that. And another point that was touched on in the paper, which I thought is an interesting area, is how to link risk and reward. And some discussion in the paper in section 6.4 of efficient frontiers. Efficient frontiers are all very well, but they are highly dependent on the inputs, as was stated in the paper. And they do tend to force heavy weightings in the favoured asset types, that's to say the asset types that have the most favourable input parameters, unless artificial limits are imposed. And of course, as soon as you get to that stage, you're falling back once again on judgment and subjectivity. The opener did draw attention to the fact that where possible we should use market price for risk when hedgeable, and I think we probably all endorse that. But of course, as has already been said, not all risks are hedgeable. And if they're not, we need to be able to work out, first of all, how much capital we should be holding against those risks, and also estimating what we expect the return on that capital to be, because that's an important element of business planning. And for all of these things, we need a real-world model, which then brings us back to the questions that I've just raised about what distributions to use and so on. So I think the paper raises lots of interesting issues, lots of interesting questions, It may be that if I delved into some of the literature, I'd have got some further answers to some of these questions. But I'd like to thank the author for drawing them all to our attention.
Thank you very much, Tim. Now, Paul, is there anything you'd like to come back on in the discussion so far to try and generate more contributions from the floor?
There's an awful lot of comments there that I was hoping to put together into a coherent conclusion whilst Michael's closing the discussion, but there's a few things.
Well, you can certainly do that if you
so I'll, in the same way that whilst a coherent risk measures are always preferable to incoherent risk measures, I'm trying to reasonably incoherent summary of some of the most recent comments. In terms of which distribution you pick, it really depends on how important that part of your modelling is. If it is absolutely core to the job that you're doing, it's over a very short period of time, and you are having to assess your risk as accurately as possible, then you want to know exactly what the shape of the distribution is, which probably won't be normal. You know, want to know exactly what the shape of the tail of the distribution is. You want to know what the dependency function between various other distributions is, which probably won't be correlation because you'll probably have different dependencies in the tail and in the middle. And that, to a large extent, I believe, is what many banks do when they're trying to model their risk on a daily basis, when they're looking at value at risk on a daily basis, and what different financial variables is. So they'll make sure that they have exactly what they believe the shape of the distributions and the links between the distributions to be correct, and also parameterise them exactly to the market. Now, if you're looking over a 10-year time horizon, trying to find the same sort of information probably isn't going to be as feasible, particularly if you also have a lot of unhedgeable risks in there. And if your asset distribution risk isn't necessarily going to be the overwhelming risk that takes everything, that dominates everything else, then you might be able to use less exact models, such as normal distribution, for those different for that part of your modelling. So I really think it does depend on exactly what you're doing, on how much effort you'll put into that. I also think as well that there's something to be said for not being too exact in a lot of forms of asset modelling, because if you are, say, doing some asset liability modelling for a pension fund client and you explain great depth in a 100-page document exactly how you parameterised your asset model, then they're going to think this is really cast iron, rock solid. And it often isn't. It's often as well to not over-parameterise, not over-complicate things, to make it clear that this is going to give, say, pension scheme trustees an indication of the level of risk they're taking, but not seeking to be the definitive record of exactly how much risk they're taking, because in many cases the numbers that you get to put into your model means that you're not going to get out an appreciably more accurate result using that more complicated approach than you would from a higher level approach. I do think that is important. In terms of the efficient frontiers, if you're just using Markowitz efficient frontier, then you are in great risk of having the portfolio change every time you change an expected return by a tenth of a percent. And there's a number of ways around that. One is to see what happens if you do change some of your results by a tenth of a percent, and then try and target the portfolios which always stay fairly close to the efficient frontier rather than ones that are right on the edge and then move to being absolutely hopeless at other times. But there's other ways that you can look at efficient frontiers by doing some form of resampling, which I described briefly in the paper, but effectively what you're doing is you're allowing for some variability in the assumptions by looking at a lot of very, very small samples. And an alternative approach is to say, well, rather than say what assumptions we think are appropriate, you can say, well, I think the market knows what the right assumptions are, so I'll take the market asset allocation as being efficient, and then back out the assumptions that will get me to that result. And both of those
approach is generally come up with more sensible asset allocations than the ones that always suggest that you have 50% in hedge funds and 50% in commodities, which tends to happen if you use unconstrained market risk optimization.
Very good. Thank you very much. Well, that's given you a bit more time to think about what you want to say. Who's going to be brave? Yes, Paul.
Paul Gregan. Just building on Catherine's point earlier on about Solvency II being principle-based regulation, one of the key challenges in developing models and making decisions is going to be around building corporate memory. So how we interpreted regulation, how we devised the model, what the model was intended to do and why, and having that documented, audited, and stored somewhere. Because over time, with the benefit of hindsight, if and when things do go wrong, that's where we're going to be challenged around why we did what we did at the time. And with everybody moving around and we're pooling of resources, you know, there needs to be a corporate memory to say we did this because, and then as we improve and change models or rationales, we can then justify what we've changed and why. It's just sort of a wider point really around linking back to the regulatory compliance and why we need to do what we do. You know, there needs to be some way of storing that information centrally.
Very good, thank you. Nobody seems to be anxious to catch my eye. I can just say a bit in response to the comment earlier on from the person near the back who suggested we ought to be doing more to advertise the profession's capabilities in this area. I think that you make a very good point that we perhaps should be doing more to market the profession. There is a bit of chicken and egg about this, though. We can't really market ourselves as experts in an area until we have acquired the necessary expertise. And I think the actuarial profession has come a long way in understanding risk better over the past 5 years. Partly thanks to the FSA and the introduction of the ICAS regime. But I guess we have to admit that we don't know all the answers at this stage. 99.5% VAR over a one-year time horizon probably isn't the last word in sophistication. And I think, as Paul mentioned in the paper, it doesn't necessarily capture the interactions between risks very well or deal with non-linearity. So I think there's a lot more work that the profession could do to improve its understanding of risk management. In some areas of risk, a lot has been done already. I think longevity is a good example where there have been some very good papers, some very good research done. A lot still that we don't understand, a lot more still to do. But it's interesting that a lot of money is now coming into the bulk buyout market, or has come into the bulk buyout market, from people wanting to take on longevity risk, and it's essentially actuaries who are being relied upon to make the assessments of those risks. But other areas of risk management, I'm sure a lot more that still needs to be done to improve our understanding, and certainly a lot of scope for further research projects. In terms of advertising the profession, it's perhaps interesting to look at what the US profession is doing in terms of branding. The Society of Actuaries has embarked on a branding campaign. Its slogan is "Risk is Opportunity," and whether you like that or not, they've certainly put quite a lot of effort into positioning the profession as the profession that understands risk. One of the things that they're doing is to champion some of the what they call the pioneers within the profession, those people who've moved from traditional actuarial areas into new types of work. And so that includes putting profiles on the website and so on. And I think there's probably more that we could do in the UK to champion some of our more successful members, both in new areas and in business generally. Any other comments from the floor? Yes, two. Right. Sorry. No, you can go. You haven't had a go, so you go first, and then Tim can come back.
Hi, Pete Mays. I certainly share the view that's already been expressed, which I think the paper is a very good flavour of risk quantification techniques to date. I guess I'd just like to then almost just add a really good positive note to this, which is that risk management is not a perfect science. And I guess no matter what models one uses, it will always require some judgment in terms of the inputs that go into those models. And I think that the benefit we can add as actuaries is actually communicate clearly to the users of the information that at the end of the day this isn't a perfect science, and that actually other techniques need to be used along with the quantification models. For example, using point of failure stress testing, developing actually a whole range of scenarios based on past events, or actually just asking boards and risk management committees to think about future events and actually illustrating those results alongside those of any model. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Tim.
Thank you. A couple of thoughts. I accept the metaphorical slack risk from Donald about disinterest in equations. I don't think actuaries should be disinterested in equations. I think they should be very interested in equations and the numbers that go underneath them. I think one of the things this paper does is encapsulate a lot of numbers that sit underneath equations in words that can be understood by the perhaps the less mathematically inclined reader. And I think that is a very important part of our profession, in being able to communicate highly technical things to less technical audience, and in a way that's the paper is a good example of that. And to pick up a point that Paul Gray made a little while ago, I very much support the importance of documenting the corporate memory, but also I stress the importance of, if you like, not being afraid to change your corporate memory. Techniques do move on, things change, and there has been some in the past, and the profession possibly has been guilty of it, of adopting the approach of new information has come along, but it might just be a blip. I remember in the exam papers years ago, questions were set which said, you know, the rate of interest has halved or equities have fallen, and the standard answer is, oh well, I do nothing for a couple of years in case it was a blip. we all know now that that is not the appropriate way to work, so we have moved on, but we necessarily need to move on in our risk management techniques as well, as in any new field, of saying, well, if things have moved on, we won't do nothing for a couple of years in case it's a blip. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much, Tim. Who's next? Yes, Donald.
Donald Duval again. I quite like the Society's actuary slogan, risk is opportunity, because I think that people tend to think of risk management as trying to deal with problems, whereas an awful lot of what we are trying to do is actually make money out of risk or use it positively. So I think that, and I think that's a potentially useful way of distinguishing actuaries from others in the risk management area. Not that we can manage risk, but actually we can find opportunity in risk. And the example you gave of money coming into the buyout market and trusting actuaries is one area of that. The other thing I was going to go back to was a question you raised some time ago about whether the pensions board was right to suggest that actuaries shouldn't or should take care about getting involved in sponsor credit risk. I think Malcolm's entirely right. We have a much greater business risk than the credit rating agencies because they are completely exempt from liability. I understand they're categorised with journalists in that respect, that it's completely impossible to sue them, however negligent they are. We certainly wouldn't be in that category. But from now, having seen quite a lot of work, including a lot done by accountants who are fully liable, of course, the big issue that they're all missing is the holistic nature of the risk, because they are all experienced in dealing with claims which are totally fixed in amount and term, bonds and the like, whereas a pension fund claim is not fixed in that way at all. The amount of the claim depends on how you invest the money and also how much is paid now. In principle, if a sponsor pays nothing now, they will have to pay more later, but how much more will depend on what happens in the meantime. And I think that interaction at the moment, no one that I've seen is successfully modelling or addressing, and I think actuaries have at least as good a claim and ability to do that as anybody else. No one has perfect professional skills in that. It's a new area. But I think it's entirely right for actuaries to get into that.
Can I?
Yes,
just say, I do think that the rating agencies might possibly take exception to your kind comments about them. Also, there's some very, very bright people who work for all the leading rating agencies. And so one of the interesting challenges, I think, as a profession we have, is that there are other people out there who are perceived in the marketplace as experts. We are attempting to compete against them. So picking up on your comments earlier, one needs to be slightly careful how you go and market actuaries, because whilst we do have a lot that we can bring to the party, there are a lot of other people who also have a lot that they can bring to the party.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. Geraldine.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Just that you must realise that actuaries and rating agencies are not mutually exclusive, and some of these very bright people are actuaries.
Glad to hear it.
Thank you very much. Right. Your last chance now. Does anyone want to make a final contribution from the floor? I think not, in which case, Mike, are you ready?
Yes, indeed.
Very good. Okay, I'll ask Mike Kipling to close the discussion.
I'd like to, first of all, echo the many speakers tonight who have thanked Paul Sweeting for producing such a comprehensive and accessible paper on the modelling and management of risk associated with financial institutions, especially, but not exclusively, insurance companies and pension funds. Since the advent of the Financial Services Authority's individual capital assessment regime, there can be few actuarial advisers to UK insurers who have not been intimately involved in modelling the risks outlined in this paper. However, even for them, this paper serves as a useful checklist to ensure that no material risks have been overlooked or have been inappropriately measured. For those advising defined benefit pension schemes and their sponsoring employers, perhaps there are more fundamental messages to assimilate. Whilst it is not necessary for either the fund or the employer to hold risk capital, it is surely useful for both trustees and employer to be aware of the level of capital which would provide virtual certainty of benefit delivery, even if this knowledge is expressed rather in terms of an extreme maximum deficit to be funded. As in any paper which covers such a wide range of substance and applicability, readers will inevitably find areas which the author could have covered in greater depth. For example, when opening, Malcolm Kemp would have wanted to see a little more demonstration of the profession's prowess in mathematics, and also a little more focus on the governance of risk. In particular, however, he wanted to challenge the apparent acceptance of the traditional actuarial approach, espousing instead the market consistent route. I agree. Indeed, there are many amongst us who now regret the unhedgeable risks taken on by our actuarial predecessors. Let us hope that some lessons have been learned. According to Derek Pike, though, had Paul extended this paper to cover every aspect of risk, it would have amounted to some 800 pages, rather beyond the upper limit in the Institute's guidance to authors. Tim Burse then warned us of the spurious accuracy which may arise from adding broad measures derived using applied common sense to detailed technical results from the more statistically tractable risks, and of the need to be careful not to accidentally add explicit prudence on top of implicit prudence. Paul Gray, our sole brave non-actuarial guest tonight, reminded us of the educative value of analysing a business's risks so that those in a position to be able to prevent them are aware of the risk exposures to over which they have control. He later reminded us of the need to establish a corporate memory, although I forget exactly why. Donald Duval urged us not to be afraid of demonstrating the profession's mathematical skills if we wanted to prosper in the risk management field. And he also made a rather controversial remark about service levels for closed life funds, about which I will see him outside. Malcolm Kemp and Nigel Bankhead both addressed actuaries' ability to assess the credit risk of individual firms and warned those attempting to do this to check their PI cover very carefully. Information was a common theme in the discussion, especially information conveyed by the market price mechanism. The depth of the market was important, and Malcolm speculated that the actuarial profession's fate was perhaps to operate at the shallow end. The newly bemedalled chairman of the Northwest Actuarial Society agreed with the author on the ability of GI actuaries to extend themselves for assisting banks in assessing credit risk, particularly where the credit risk arises from insurable, but not necessarily insured, events in the first place. After a brief foray into the need for more education of actuaries on ERM and into the need to publicise what some of us can already do, Pete Mays reminded us of the need for scenario analyses informed by the whole management team, and Tim Burse reminded us not to let blips become blots. Finally, Donald Duval slandered, or is it libelled, the rating agencies, but Malcolm Kemp and Geraldine Kay nobly leapt to their defence. One area where I personally felt there could have been a little more depth is what in the insurance company ICA context, and indeed as the President has just mentioned, become known as non-linearity. 5.1.10 refers indirectly to it in the context of market risk, where the inadequacies of the use of correlation alone are rightly highlighted, especially, as Tim Bunch told us, if the correlation matrices contain a fair degree of subjective choice. The use of copulas or other mathematical techniques is recommended in the paper. While such techniques may work for specific combinations of mathematically tractable risk distributions, when it comes to the combined effect of economic, demographic and operational risks, a more practical alternative is currently really needed. Practitioners are developing tools which seek to identify least solvent likely events by iterative means. Essentially, these are multi-risk events with a desired, for example, 0.5% probability at which the combined loss is greatest. For some risk combinations, the additional risk capital requirement compared to a simple correlation approach can be substantial. For example, if liabilities are closely matched against interest rate movements based on a particular set of demographic assumptions, the joint impact of an adverse change in demographic assumptions coincident with an adverse change in interest rates can be much more severe than the result of a simple combination of the individual stresses using a correlation matrix. Another area which receives little coverage, in my own view, is risk appetite. Most financial institutions will have subjectively expressed risk appetites, sometimes expressed as the blindingly obvious, for example, zero appetite for fraud, although it should be noted that in practice this achievement could never be proven. An obvious objective measure is so that the available capital of the bank, insurer or sponsoring employer is not exhausted with a very high and enumerated probability. Less obvious, perhaps, are measures relating to maximum acceptable shocks to reported profits in any year, or to a quoted firm's share price, or to embedded value, which is similar. There may be different levels of appetite to different risks, depending upon the exposure of the relevant peer group to the same risks. For example, some firms may consider that to suffer reduced profits or reduced value from market shocks, no more than proportionately to competition, is less damaging than to suffer damage from a unique risk exposure. Finally, the paper has focused very much on what in Basel II or Solvency II terms we might term Pillar 2, the firm's own assessment of its risk exposures. But there is, of course, a third pillar, disclosure. How to ensure that the stakeholders described in Section 2 of the paper are sufficiently aware of the risk exposure of the organisation to enable them to make informed decisions on whether to maintain or break, where they can, their financial relationships with the organisation. Whilst one might hope that corporate investors are adequately catered for via the accounts and rating agency reports, and UK bank customers and insurance policy holders by the knowledge that their firm is required to meet the tough ICA regime, assumption not always true, although failure for insurers may only be observable in retrospect by disclosure in FSA returns, pension scheme members are less well catered for. It ought not to be beyond the wit of the actuarial profession to devise some simple measures which might enable scheme members to assess the likelihood that their scheme will be able to deliver to its commitments, and how dependent that is on any discretionary decisions on support from the sponsor, or on the limits to the stressed financial capacity of that sponsor. Perhaps someone from the Northwest Actuarial Society would like to rise to the challenge of producing a paper on these or on other areas highlighted so ably by Paul Sweeting this evening.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mike. Paul, you've had time there, I think, to produce a coherent and possibly even elegant response to the discussion.
Yeah, thanks for the build-up. I would have. Unfortunately, I have no material left because I used all of it. There are three areas that I'd really like to concentrate on this summing up. The first is the equations part, which I didn't think would generate as much discussion as it did. There were two main reasons. Well, one broad reason for not including equations in the paper. This was a brief overview of risk measures, which already ran to 42 pages, I think the BAJ is the only journal which would regard that as a brief paper. Most of it would throw it out and say to Harvard. It certainly wasn't because I didn't think that people were mathematically incapable of understanding many of the concepts. What I really wanted to get across in this paper was a broad overview of all the sorts of areas that people are exploring, are using, and should be using across a wide range of different types of risks. And I said to the introduction, and I'll repeat now, if you look at the references in this paper, there's some really good stuff there, particularly the books. I would have included more from those books, but they do better than I do in talking about some of these risks in terms of equations, and if I had included it, it would have been quite pure plagiarism. So I would look at some of those references. The one that springs to mind is the De Servigne and Renault book on credit risk, which is very interesting and just shows you how far assessment of credit risk has come since the Altman Z score. Another area which generated considerable discussion, which I was expecting, was around the skills that actuaries have. Now, I'm not suggesting that all actuaries can be fully fledged credit raters, recognising the fact that there are already some actuaries who are fully fledged credit raters who are working in credit rating agencies. But a lot of the maths involved in looking at some of these other risks that actuaries wouldn't already look at aren't that difficult. And there are a lot of similarities between the risks that we are considering and the risks that we should be considering. And I think it's worth noting that if, going back to the corporate sponsored credit risk example, if we go back to that and we accept that if actuaries do it and they do it consistently with the pension scheme assets, there are things that we're going to be missing. Well, rating agencies are doing it at the moment, and there's one big thing they're already missing, which is what the pension scheme is going to be doing whilst they're modelling the pension scheme risk. So I'm not saying we're doing it perfectly, but it's certainly an area where I think we ought to be getting involved. The final area that I wanted to talk about was the area of market consistency. I think it's absolutely desirable that when you're valuing assets and liabilities, you do so in as market consistent a way as possible. And I do really like the idea of being able to package up and securitise as many risks as possible. And I particularly like the idea of trying to triage them out as well. So you just don't just take a single risk and sell it to market as is, but you give people the choice of having a greater or a lesser degree of security within that particular risk. I think that's a very powerful idea and will be very attractive for many investors. It is worth recognising that it isn't always possible to find a market consistent price for risks, and then we have to fall back on less perfect, more judgmental approaches. And I also think it's worth recognising that when you're talking about trying to value a risk, trying to reserve for something, market consistency is important. If you're trying to price something and decide whether to go into the market or not, and trying to decide how much to charge, then the price implied by the market isn't necessarily the best price, because you might not win as much business as you'd otherwise like, and oftentimes the reason that you're going into the market in the first place is because you believe the market has got it wrong, so you want to go in with a different price. The final point I'd make is that several comments were made on areas where I could have expanded this paper and areas where I could have gone into greater detail, which is why it's particularly handy that this paper is available online in a wiki format, which means that people can actually go online and edit the paper themselves and add their own comments to it. And everyone is invited to make any alterations or augmentations to this paper, preferably saying who you are so you can see who's added the helpful comments. And if you would like to access the wiki, then if you get in touch with Sally Grover at Staple Inn, she'll be able to give you the details of where it's kept and how you can make those changes. Finally, I would like to say thank you once again for inviting me to speak. I've enjoyed listening to all your comments. Over to you again, Nick.
Very good. Thank you very much, Paul. Well, we've had a very readable paper this evening and an excellent discussion. I think we can agree that we all love equations, really, but it's quite nice to have a break from them from time to time. It just remains for me to express my thanks, and I'm sure the thanks of all of us, to Paul, to Malcolm, and to Mike, and to all of those who participated in this evening's discussion. Can we show our appreciation, please? Thank you very much. Now, it would also be very helpful for those who are preparing the abstract of the discussion for the BAJ if you could hand any prepared notes to Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons as you leave the meeting. The next sessional meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 o'clock at Staple Inn Hall on Monday the 21st of May 2007, 3 weeks from today, when a discussion on general insurance premium rating, the way forward, will take place. Hope to see some of you there. And I'll now hand back to Catherine to close the meeting.
Thank you, Nick. Before we close, I'd like to thank the Secretary of the North West Actuarial Society, Emma West, for all her excellent work in organising much of this evening. Thank you, Emma. And also Maria and Pauline for all their hard work in organising the meeting too. For those of you that are joining us for dinner, this will take place at 7:45 for 8 p.m. in the main restaurant on the first floor. And in the meantime, you're all very welcome to attend the drinks reception, which is sponsored by the Northwest Actuarial Society, and that's going to take place in the promenade area on the next floor down. And while you're there, you'll have the opportunity to browse the current exhibition by Ian Berry, which is entitled In the North and Ian Berry, The Water Project. Thank you very much for coming this evening, and I declare the meeting closed.